Welcome to Worst Year Ever, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
What? Auntie, my fascism now. No, that's not good. That was a failure of an introduction. That was a failure of an introduction and also legally a call to terrorism, I think. Now, I think me saying that makes me and all of you a terrorist, and by definition also Spotify a terrorist. I don't know. That's why today I'm here, sans Katie and Cody, who have disappeared for reasons mysterious,
I'm here.
Talk about... Sophie is here. Thank you, Sophie.
I'm here.
You are.
I just wanted to be heard.
We're the co-hosts of Worst Year Ever today, and we're going to talk about the president's declaration that Antifa is a terrorist group with my friend and lawyer, Moira Cohen. Moira, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay, given the givens. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Was I accurate in stating that Spotify is now legally a terrorist?
I actually cannot give legal advice over the radio or on a podcast, so I just can't comment on that. I also want to remind you that this conversation is not privileged.
That's good to know. That's good to know. And I'm taking that as a big maybe on Spotify as a terrorist. So if you're the CIA, please start sending Spotify arms. Moira, we're in a weird situation, and you're the person I call whenever scary things happen involving the law, because I don't understand the law. All I understand is to ask a police officer if I'm being detained.
That's a really good start. You're ahead of the game there.
So, you want to walk me through kind of, I'm curious, as not just a lawyer, but as like a movement lawyer, as somebody who deals with cases that relate directly to let's say political activism on a regular basis. When you wake up in the morning or whatever it was, when did you hear that the president had stared out at our crumbling nation and decided that Antifa was the blame?
Well, you know, I don't know if you've noticed this since the pandemic, but time is now fake.
Yeah, yes. It is a flat circle these days.
So I honestly can't tell you what day that was. What I can tell you is I woke up to a flurry of panicked text messages from just about everyone I've ever represented asking whether they were about to go to federal prison.
Yeah. Yeah, I had that moment of panic.
Yeah, I guess. Whatever day that was a busy day.
Yeah.
I think in the words of Janis Joplin, it's all the same fucking day, man.
Yeah.
The answer generally is no, you're not all about to go to federal prison. I guess that's the good news.
That is good news. I don't think I would like federal prison.
Very few people do.
Yeah, I don't want to like prejudge it because that's not okay. But that's my gut feeling on the matter.
Yeah. So sometimes I have days as an attorney where I feel like I'm being gaslit by the entire state. And that was one of those days where I thought, did I miss a tremendous change in law while I was sleeping? Did I just wake up to a world where the First Amendment is utterly meaningless? And it sort of rattled me, and I had to take a minute and step back and think about it and do a little analysis and say, no, this proclamation is legally, for the time being, meaningless. But unfortunately, that doesn't mean it's socially or culturally meaningless, and it doesn't mean that it won't have impacts.
Sure.
In the way the law is enforced, or in the way cases move through the legal system.
And there are actually, like, I think one of the things that's important to understand, because this ties into also aspects of why there's a lot of reasons why the federal government fell on its ass in terms of responding to right-wing violence, particularly in the last 4 years or so. But one of them is kind of related to the difficulty of declaring something a domestic terrorist group. Like, there's a lot of restrictions on that. Would you mind giving, like, a little overview of, like, what that actually is?
Sure. So I think I'm going to actually zoom out even a little farther than that.
Sure,
if that's okay. So I think a thing that I want to remind your listeners of is that the law writ large is not a set of facts. It's not a static thing. It's always a set of arguments. So when we talk about what the law is, that isn't always a stable thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think I referred to this a second ago. While it's obviously important to know the substance of the doctrine that we're dealing with, if we get too narrowly focused on that doctrine, we might miss the fact that there's law and there's law enforcement, and those can be two radically different things, right? So in terms of what we're talking about with respect to terrorism, and in particular domestic terrorism, this matters in terms of Trump's proclamation about Antifa being a terrorist organization, because in fact he does not have authority to declare anything a domestic terrorist organization. The State Department can declare foreign organizations to be foreign terrorist organizations. And that is a profound power that they have. And it's extremely dangerous and it's extremely problematic, in my opinion. But because, at least for the time being, we do in this country have the freedom of belief and association, they're going to run up against problems with passing constitutional muster to the extent that they're trying to declare a group to be a terrorist, a domestic terrorist organization.
Well, Ms. Yeah, just especially since, and I think, like, this is the thing that I think willfully of folks politically on the right misunderstand a lot, like, Antifa isn't a group. It's like a set, it's a mix of a set of tactics and a set of beliefs. And there are some groups like, you know, Rose City Antifa in my own city who espouse those beliefs and tactics. But, like, fundamentally what you'd be saying if you actually did criminalize Antifa is you're criminalizing an ideology, which we don't get to do here.
That is correct. I think that it is interesting to look at that misapprehension, and it's hard to tell to what degree it's willful and to what degree it might be just a function of the fact that the authoritarian right does have membership organizations like the Klan that do have a clear hierarchy where you do pay membership dues, where you do have a clear and coherent set of beliefs that are outlined. It may just be a little bit beyond them culturally to understand a movement or a set of tactics that are a little less defined, right? But I think it's important to understand that law enforcement, generally, from the slave patrols through the use of vagrancy laws to do racist policing, to police unsheltered people, to police gender nonconforming people. All of these laws are laws that are enforced in terms of policing identity or status. But because of those constitutional problems that I referred to a minute ago, they're framed in terms of policing conduct, even though we know that they're used to police identity, right? Mm-hmm. I think the kind of interesting thing that we're looking at with Trump's proclamation is that he is making no bones about the fact that he is trying to police identity rather than conduct, which is a shift, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what scares...
Well, I mean, that's where he's going to have problems. And that's why if we're going to focus narrowly on what is what he has the legal authority to do, does he have the legal authority to say Antifa, which even setting aside for the moment, is not a membership organization? Does he have the authority to say that this group is unlawful? Well, no, he doesn't. That's not a power that he actually has. But it neither does it matter, right? And I think that's the thing that we need to really drill down on here.
And how does, this might be a dumb question, but like, how does Twitter interact with all of this? Because him just announcing things that are legally not true on Twitter is one of those things that I'm like, how the fuck is this still happening? And why is he... Like, it's not, it, is there, like, any type of protection? Like, I don't understand how he can do that.
I do feel like there are a lot of people within the federal government and even within law enforcement who are trying to figure out what does it mean when the president announces something like this on Twitter. I wish if I could tweet and make policy,
well,
things would be terrible. Things would be really bad.
I don't recommend. There would be weird shit.
It couldn't possibly be any weirder than the actual shit that's going on.
That is true. And cocaine would be legal. Is cocaine legal, Moira?
Cocaine is not legal.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. No problem. So the president can tweet these kinds of things for the same reason the rest of us can, and that is because of the very First Amendment.
Yeah. I'm wondering, though, like, but there's, like, we're in this weird, there's, like, this very unsettling thing, and I guess some of it's just simply the problem that we have a chief executive in which a great deal of power is vested, mm-hmm. and a huge amount of that power is informal. So, like, the president has his constitutional powers, which have existed for forever, and then he has the powers which have evolved over time, mm-hmm. And many of those powers that have evolved over time are based on just sort of, like, people listen to the president. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that's what we're seeing with this Antifa stuff more than anything else. Yeah.
That's exactly right, Robert. And so I think the general point that I want to make, and if there's any clarity that I can give your listeners, it's that there is a difference between lawful authority and enforcement power. Right? And there is a difference between the lawful authority of the president to make policy and the ability of the president to broadcast both to state and non-state actors that certain kinds of behavior against certain kinds of people will be tolerated or encouraged, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
And so... You know, when we talk about does Trump have the authority to designate, quote, Antifa, whatever that means, as a terrorist organization, it does not matter whether or not he has the authority to do that because he has communicated something altogether different that will nevertheless have real material impacts for how policing happens at every level, for how prosecutions and investigations, convictions and sentencings happen, right? Because the word terrorist is a discursive placeholder that allows everyone from police officers to juries to judges granting warrants to rationalize their decisions with respect to this word terrorist, as opposed to the unexamined ideology through which they are filtering all of these narratives, requests for warrants, their understanding as police officers of who it is they're looking at. And so to say Antifa, which is not a real category of person, right, is a terrorist organization, suddenly creates this empty signifier that is malleable enough to include or exclude just about anyone.
Right. And it's wild to me that he so freely can tweet using the word terrorist when he refuses to use it when there's white school shooters who have his belief system, and there's evidence of that, and he but he can label a entire group that he knows, let's be real, nothing about, something that they're not.
I mean, as with so many problems that we're having with this administration and right now, the problem isn't, like, the problem is something that has existed for forever. Because, like, this is something that I've heard a lot of comparisons being made between what people are afraid will happen with this Antifa declaration and the satanic panic of the late 80s, I think, early 90s, which was, like, there's no law against being a Satanist. And also, Satanists don't do any of the things that people were punishing Satanists for doing, and none of those crimes actually occurred, but people still went to prison for them. And it, I think it's because of the same thing, like, you're talking about, this fact that, like, the fact that this is in the air, and, you know, part of a declaration by the president gives kind of permission for judges and for prosecutors and stuff to go after individuals more stringently. And it, there's a quote from, I think it was, from the old, like, what it was, 60s or 70s, movie about, like, movie series about the Bible with, George C. Scott as Moses. If you ever saw that, I think that's where this from, where the line is Moses saying, man should be ruled by law, not by the will of other men. Which is a nice idea, but
I'm curious about where Moses thinks law comes from or how it is enforced.
Well, I think it was a coked up screenwriter who put those words in his mouth.
Fair enough.
But it does seem like we're being, I don't know, ruled by kind of the idle will of those in power, which I guess we always have been, but usually there's more of a mask on about it.
I'm actually going to disagree with you.
Okay, no, I'm glad to be disagreed with, because that's a bleak way to look at things.
Yes, disagree with him, please. No, I'm just excited.
Well, let's see how hard we are going to fight about this. So, I don't think this idea that there's a moral panic, you know, certainly the moral panic over Satanists and is sort of similar to what's happening with Antifa, but it's by no means the only or even the most obvious precursor of what we're seeing here, right? Fugitive Slave Act on down. The police have always gone after people who in any way were even perceived as a threat to
absolutely
dominance, right? And so abolitionists, labor movements, women's rights movements, Puerto Rican independence, the Black Panthers, the Black Liberation Army, environmental activists, anarchists, anarchists both in the 19th century and then again in the mid-2000s.
They do like going after us, yeah.
Right? Obviously the Red Scare, right? McCarthyism. Yeah. This is by no means a new thing. I think it is a little, because of the executive that we happen to be dealing with right now, there is less of a veneer.
Yeah.
I think he's less sophisticated about the way in which he expresses these things. And so it might be somewhat more unvarnished. But it's certainly not a new tactic.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is just the first time it's happened on Twitter. Yeah. And you're right. We're doing this series on the police right now in our normal feed to give everybody and talking about a lot of what you were talking about is how the police have been sort of the term that's used in one of the texts I read was designated vigilantes for kind of the primary power group in American culture. Whoever that happens to be and whatever they happen to be afraid of, the police are used to fuck those people up. And yeah, you're absolutely right. And I guess that is, I think it does seem like Trump's kind of calling a shot with this, that he hopes that, like, I think that this is the group that enough of the Americans who have, you know, money and power and who vote see these people as the boogeyman of our times, that I can, going after them will work out politically and be tolerated politically by me. Like, I guess that's what I guess we don't really know if that will be the case, but that's the shot he's calling.
Absolutely. And certainly he's manufacturing that boogeyman.
Yeah.
He's working really hard to do that. And I think along with its sort of twin discourse of the outside agitator, he's kind of creating these mutually reinforcing boogeymen, right, that are, you know, deeply racist, deeply anti-Semitic. Both of these discourses have a long history of being used to erase Black radicalism and agency and blame any kind of mass resistance on a few outsiders with sinister ulterior motives, right?
Yeah.
Who are in some way behind the scenes, you know, in charge of things. You know, I'm actually going to, if you give me a second, I'm going to take a look at some questions that the Joint Terrorism Task Force was asking.
While Moira looks that up, why don't we take an ad break? What do you think?
Yeah, speaking of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, you know, who doesn't coordinate federal agencies
in
fighting terrorism? Yeah,
yes, Moira. Who is it?
The fine products and services that support Robert's programs.
That's right. That's right.
Facts.
I thought it might be.
Welcome to the worst year ever. Together or not. Everything is so dumb.
We are back and we're talking about Friends of the Pod, the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
So if you recall, I think at the very beginning we were talking about the difficulty that the right, the authoritarian right, has understanding that Antifa is not a membership organization with a clear hierarchy that is in charge of, in charge of anti-fascists and protesters. And I think there's one of the ways in which we see this manifest is in the way that law enforcement interacts with people that they perceive as being in some way adjacent to Antifa. And so over the last couple of weeks of these uprisings in New York, a number of people who were arrested in the course of their First Amendment protected activity were pulled aside and questioned by members of the NYPD and members of the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And some of the questions they were asked were, "What do you know about Antifa? Why did you come to New York City?" So this is an interesting assumption that the people who have been arrested are not from New York City. Yeah. Are you in Antifa? What do you do to organize protests? Who told you about the protest? Do you use social media? Do you follow protest-related accounts? Who is in charge of the protests? I think that's my favorite.
That's always the funniest one to me, because they're all like, generally speaking, very kind of like enmeshed in hierarchy, and they have trouble imagining that you could get a 1,500, 2,000, 3,000, thousands of people into the streets acting in concert without like a dude.
Right.
Those questions are stupid. I mean, like, minus the New York part, it's like my dogs could be qualified for half of those. Like, what?
I mean, you know, there's a lot of promise in the social media one. I think it should be criminalized to use social media. Yeah, throw us all in prison for using Twitter, including the president. Lock us up.
It's my devout hope that whomever was asked whether they use social media just okay boomered that cop.
Yeah.
No, don't okay boomer cops, though. In all seriousness, if any police officer asks you anything, just say, I am going to remain silent. And I want to speak to a lawyer. However attractive an option it might seem to be really snarky, just don't do it.
Yeah, they can use those tasers for, like, no reason.
That's true.
at least. At minimum.
That's one law thing I do know.
People ask me a lot, like, when can the police arrest me? Right. And I always say anyone can be arrested at any time for any reason or no reason at all. Mm-hmm. The answer is whenever they want to. That doesn't mean that you're going to end up being charged or convicted.
Sure.
But important to keep in the back of your mind that there are some ways that you can almost guarantee your arrest, but there are really no ways to guarantee that you will not be arrested. The big takeaway here about Trump, however, whether he's announcing this on Twitter, whether it's coming in a press conference, you know, however this information is being broadcast, what he's doing is not signaling a change in law. He's working to cultivate a change in the culture of law enforcement. And a change in law is not necessary for the state to get what they want in this case, right? And this is especially true if we consider the fact that the state does not need to prevail in criminal cases or find anything damning in criminal investigations in order to massively disrupt social movements, right? I think everyone is probably familiar with the J20 cases where more than 200 people were kettled and arrested, and the DC circuit, I think, tried to allege a conspiracy among all those people. And, you know, they failed spectacularly, as I like to say, on a technicality, namely that the defendants were innocent.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Well, I think it's critical to think that through, though, because, as I said, this effort to indicate that we're, you know, that Trump is going to designate a kind of person rather than a type of conduct as unlawful is going to get him into trouble for the same reason that the prosecutors in the J20 cases ended up running up against trouble, because the very attributes that they were trying to use as evidence of a conspiracy or as evidence of membership in this conspiracy or participation in this conspiracy are things like belief, style of clothing, presence in a place that are protected by the First Amendment. And that still matters, right? It doesn't mean that it always matters. It doesn't mean that it matters as much as we might want it to. But we do still have the First and Fourth Amendments, and trying to criminalize identity as identity without any other cover, right, of identifying a kind of conduct that is unlawful is going to end up being hard for them. But that said, okay, they don't prevail in those cases in court, but defending criminal cases, dealing with grand jury subpoenas, these are stressful, they take a lot of energy from movements. They take a lot of resources and time from movements. They're frightening for people. They create a lot of mistrust within communities. And the fact is, they really take the wind out of the sails of movements, because once a single arrest is made, the focus is no longer on the message of that movement. The focus is no longer on whatever that movement was resisting. It becomes focused now on the criminality of protesters or the criminality of the people who are seeking a change. It becomes focused on individuals within that movement rather than a mass movement or a social movement or a set of ideals, which makes it much more difficult for people who don't already identify with that movement to see themselves in it, right? And so it's not a bad tactic for Trump to really foment this fear of Antifa, whether or not it has any legal impact. At the end of the day, we're still going to go through potentially years of criminal cases, of investigations, of media that totally undermine the capacity of large, broad-based movements to focus narrowly on whatever it is that, you know, in this case, on racial justice, right?
How much does this, so like one thing that I keep thinking of when I'm thinking about like the worst case scenario for all this is the Green Scare, right? Mm-hmm. Where you had this kind of burgeoning environmental, I don't know what you want to call it, environmental justice movement that was heavily criminalized. People who were trying to take like direct action in order to stop some of the stuff that we're all seeing the consequences of now. And the government went after these people and threw a lot of them in prison for a lot of them was the rest of their lives. A ton of them committed suicide in prison and stuff. It's a terrible, terrible story. And it kind of, it's part of why, at least I have some friends who were, you know, activists during that period of time and who will credit as kind of why things in a lot of ways started from zero when Occupy hit again, because like so much kind of institutional memory within our national protest infrastructure, whatever you want to call it, was wiped out by that. I don't know. I'm just interested in your thoughts on the matter, because I'm sure you know more about what happened than I do.
One of my closest friends was incarcerated as a result of the Green Scare. And one of my clients, Marius Mason, was convicted of some offenses that, had they not been deemed to be politically motivated, Marius would have gotten, I think, 7 to 10 years. And because the judge included a terrorism enhancement or enhanced the sentence as a result of his perception that these offenses were politically motivated, he's now doing, I think, 27 years.
Jesus.
Right? It might have been 22. I'm sorry. I don't remember right now. But he's still in prison as a result of the terrorism enhancement, right? And so that word terrorism really does have a devastating impact. I think that, you know, when we look at state repression of movements, it goes well beyond just our individual clients, or the individuals who are being charged, criminally charged in that moment. The impacts of that sort of echo, right? And it does function to chill even lawful speech.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid and I'm angry because it's this, you mentioned gaslighting, I think, a little bit earlier, and feeling that way by the state. And I feel that way by the state and the media when I just look at how certain things are being covered right now. Like, I think I spent a lot of the time in the field with anti-fascist activists, and I have known and seen a number of people do things like chuck a bottle or two at the police. I've definitely seen a lot of windows broken. But the number one thing, like the number one activity, the number one activity I think I've seen from anti-fascist activists has been,
either handing out free food or acting as a protest medic, right? Mm-hmm. Like those are like the two things that I've seen done the most. And I've also had actual real life terrorists try to kill me with guns and explosives. And the conflation of those two things, and the fact that so many people in the in national media are willing to, and I'm not just talking about the Fox News crowd, like the Fox News crowd kind of enthusiastically does it, but so many people outside of Fox News and what is supposed to be our credible media at least pay lip service to the fact that these might be the same things. And it makes me feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
Well, and it's also, Robert, I want to speak to that because it does have really serious implications down the road, legally. Because one of the things that happens is that we see this mainstream buy-in to this discourse about Antifa or the false equivalency between, you know, anti-fascist protesters and the Charlottesville, you know, Unite the Right people. So part of the danger of this mainstream buy-in to this discourse about anti-fascism and all of the pearl clutching and horror that are being expressed, I suspect, are a way for them to feel like they are preserving their First Amendment rights and their ability to protest in their particular correct, you know, nonviolent way, right? And they're leveraging that discourse of the anti-fascist terrorist or the outside agitator in order to protect their hegemonic dominance, right? But ultimately what they're actually functioning to do is to provide cover and authority for law enforcement to degrade the Bill of Rights as it applies to all people, not just Antifa, but to any form of protest. So I think it's actually extremely dangerous that we have so much mainstream buy-in and attempt to differentiate the good protester from the bad protester, because ultimately that is going to come back to bite all of us in the ass.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a fan of the thing that's been going around, the graffitied statement that I've seen at a couple, like the Chaz, and then I think in Nashville when they try to set up an autonomous zone, they put it up too. No bad protesters, no good cops.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's a big misunderstanding from people when they talk about a diversity of tactics, which kind of came out of, I think, St. Paul, right? And it's based on this idea that, like, a variety of different things are needed at a protest, like not just peaceful protest. Now, I think everyone's more or less in the same boat about nonviolent protest, but that's not the same as peaceful protest. And that's a distinction I do see people trying to make. But I also see a lot of people chanting peaceful protest and blaming anyone who takes direct action on quote unquote white anarchists, and I don't really know how it's all going to shake out. Like, we're in this. One of the problems with having a movement like is currently building in the nation, where you suddenly have more people engaged in activism than have ever been doing it in my lifetime, certainly, maybe like real damn briefly before the Iraq War. But that was much more geographically sort of contained. Is there's this incredible potential for grifters, too. And those grifters are always going to wind up more or less on the side of the state. Because the police love working with the right kind of protesters. Local government loves working with the right kind of protesters, because that neutralizes a movement that can be dangerous to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very dangerous for people to characterize property damage as violence. Legally and morally. I understand it may be a little easier for people, or more obvious or intuitive for people, to recognize that property damage does not morally justify police violence. I think the thing that I would like to make very clear is property damage does not legally justify police violence. And I think that that is a point that maybe has been lost a little bit.
Yeah, I think a lot about continuum of force and what justifies violence, because I always have a gun on me. And were, for example, somebody to cut the fence in my front yard and grab, you know, a set of solar panels or something and try to run away with them, and I were to shoot that person, I would go to prison. And
yeah,
I would,
you would,
unless I were maybe in the state of Texas, then it's a little bit, there's some, I know there are some times where people in Texas have gotten off with some crazy bullshit shooting people in the back in their front lawns, but not in most of the country, right? Like,
well, it depends on who you are. I would like to remind you about Trayvon Martin.
Yes. But, you know, didn't a lot of what's his name? The terrible painter who murdered him. George Zimmerman. Didn't a lot of... He made that painting. Did we all just forget about the time he tried to become a painter like George W. Bush? I'm sorry. It's just...
I know him as the guy who signed Skittle bags and sold them on the internet.
Yeah, that's probably the worst. Well, not the worst.
Or the guy that sold the gun he used on the internet for $250,000.
I do remember, though, when I was looking at sort of like the media, how people, particularly in the right-wing media, justified what Zimmerman had done. They all focused on the fact that there was a struggle, right? That, like, he was in fear of his life, quote-unquote. Yeah. So the engagement started over, you know, I guess the fear that Trayvon Martin was robbing things, but Zimmerman's justification was, you know, he was in fear of his life, right? Which I guess is, I don't know, like the police in my town have said that, like, we'll only use tear gas, you know, in life-threatening situations. But like yesterday they determined, like, some kids put a bike lock on a door, and they were like, this is threatening the lives of everybody in the building. And it was like, guys, it's a bike lock. And there's like 400 of you outside the building. Like, it'll be okay. I don't know. Sorry, I'm ranting.
I mean, that usually means it's time for an ad break.
Oh, okay.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
So, we're back. I wanted to ask you. Since I think we've covered everything, at least I had to say about the Antifa matter, I wanted to talk a little bit about some police-related stuff, since I think a lot of folks listening to this will continue to be engaging in protests, and I think we'll probably have another real big flare-up in protests, probably around August. That's just my gut feeling.
Robert, are you in charge of Antifa and the protests?
Yeah. Well, I'm the ombudsman. So actually I'm in charge of like, kind of internal complaints. So yeah, if you have an issue with your local Antifa representative or you're not getting your George Soros checks, you can drop me a line and, you know, I can help straighten that out.
Well, good to know. Yeah. I'm curious about the, you know, you seem to have some inside information about when the protests are, when the uprisings will rise up.
When it's warm. And when everybody's unemployment runs out and when eviction protections expire, that's kind of my inside intel based on looking at what's obviously going to happen.
A likely story.
Yeah, yeah. I'll have a fun conversation with the FBI about that, I'm sure. So there's like a bunch of questionable police activities. And I think it is important to note to people, like what you said, they can't arrest you for any reason. There's no such thing really as them arresting you, like not being able to legally arrest you. That's just something they get to choose to do. Like they can't always charge you. They can't always jail you, but they can always take you into custody. In terms of like we all have our list of advice for how to deal with the police if you're stopped in a car or whatever, right? Like there's a lot of videos on that. In terms of if you are, I'm wondering like what your advice is to people who are interacting with the police at protests in situations where like you're being kettled or they're trying to push a group out of something and like a riot line is advancing on you. If there's like kind of generally applicable best practices in your head, I'm curious as to what you might say on that.
Sure. So I guess I cannot give legal advice, but I can give information. And what I would say is, do your best to stay calm. Realize that the police are using arrest as a form of crowd control. And if you get detained or arrested, you will be searched incident to arrest. Mm-hmm. So think about that before you go to a protest. There is always a chance that you are going to be swept up, at which point you will be arrested, at which point you will be searched. And that means you probably should not bring anything to a protest that you don't want police officers to look at. And that doesn't just mean handguns and drugs. It means maybe your phone, right? Anything that's private, you might also want to shield from view. So I would advise people to encrypt their phone and to not use facial recognition or a fingerprint to unlock your phone. Encrypt your phone and use a passphrase. There are some really great digital security tutorials on the EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation website. There's a lot of good resources at mutantlegal.info. And then if you are arrested, you know, say very loudly, "I am not resisting."
Yeah.
And then let police officers know, you know, whatever sort of what we call pedigree information, your name and address. They're going to find out eventually. And say, if they try to question you, "I am going to remain silent and I want to speak to a lawyer." Because you do have a Fifth Amendment right against compelled self-incrimination, which means you don't have any obligation to speak to law enforcement. Whatever they tell you, you have no obligation to cooperate in a law enforcement investigation, and it is much, much safer for you not to speak to police officers or federal agents without an attorney present. And you do have a right to counsel as well. So once you invoke those rights by saying, "I am going to remain silent and I want to speak to a lawyer," once you invoke those rights, you have to then remain silent.
Yeah.
That's the key there.
They'll take advantage of the natural, when someone's friendly to you and nice, mm-hmm. even in a tense situation, particularly actually in a tense situation, there's a desire to reciprocate. Mm-hmm. And you have to not fall for that shit. The friendly cops will come out once you're being hauled in. Mm-hmm. And they are trying to get you to talk because everything you said. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, that's correct. The other thing is you should not be talking about anything in the moments leading up to your arrest or anything about planning an action while you are in custody with any of the people you've been arrested with on social media, to the press. Do not talk about this stuff to anyone but your lawyer or your doctor or therapist. Because ultimately, anything you say can and will be used against you. And that doesn't just mean things that you say directly to police. It means things that police can find out. So anything that you say publicly, you might as well be saying to a police officer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I know that there's a sort of pics or it didn't happen mentality. This is not one of those situations. Mm-hmm. I want to also tell people, if you need medical attention while you're in custody or someone else needs medical attention while you're in custody, please advocate for yourself or advocate for the person who needs medical care. Police have an obligation to render medical care, to get you to medical care if you need it. What we often hear is that police will say, "Oh, it'll take you longer to get out of custody. Don't worry about it." If you need medical care, get medical care.
Yeah, that is
both
the
because,
one.
Both because you deserve medical care and also because you need to document your injuries.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the only thing you ever say other than I'm, you know, not going to speak until my lawyer's present or whatever to a mm-hmm. police officer. The other thing I would point out, just based on some stuff I've seen recently in Portland during some interactions that could have gone badly, is when you are face-to-face, having any sort of direct interaction with a police officer, never, ever, ever put your fucking hands in your pockets. Not your jacket pockets, not your pants pockets. Hands visible the entire time. For the love of God, don't put your hands in your pockets. Don't get anything out of your pocket. Like, don't do that.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I would say as well is, I think it's widely understood now that we have the right to film police officers in the course of their employment, right?
Sure.
And that's a really important right. But you basically have the right to do this within a reasonable distance. And the people in charge of the definition of reasonable are police officers. So, you know, if they ask you to back up, I think it's not only, you know, do you sort of back up as little as possible, but narrate what you are doing, right? Mm-hmm. You can say, I'm taking a step back. Anything that you're doing in front of a police officer, it may be worth considering, can I narrate what I am currently doing? So that, first of all, so that there is a record of it. And also because it may be soothing and explain to police officers that you are not a threat. Because as I think you recently did a podcast about the way in which police officers are educated to feel embattled and threatened, being able to make clear to law enforcement that you are not a threat to them can be an important step to take. The other thing that I would say is, in the same way that we don't want you to make public statements that are basically discoverable by law enforcement that could be used as evidence against you, I would really caution people to be very circumspect about discussing any unlawful behavior in which they themselves have engaged or even that they witnessed. Because depending on what it is, anyone who ends up having knowledge or even someone who is believed, however incorrectly, to have knowledge of a federal offense can be summoned to give testimony before a federal grand jury. And there are a bunch of absolutely lawful grounds for refusing to give testimony before a federal grand jury, but it requires a great deal of litigation, and that litigation is almost always unsuccessful. And the consequence for refusing to give immunized testimony before a federal grand jury is that you can be held in civil or criminal contempt and confined in prison. So grand jury subpoenas can be extremely disruptive to movements, even and especially if nobody collaborates with the grand jury investigation. And, you know, I know that's a very abbreviated explanation of this. And there are a lot of resources about what a grand jury is and how they work online. And some of them are at that site that I mentioned before, mutantlegal.info. And it's really worth looking into those and educating yourself about what a grand jury is and how they operate. But suffice it to say, one of the ways that you can protect yourself and your community is by not boasting or speculating about unlawful conduct that you heard about or saw or engaged in, because it puts you at risk and it puts, frankly, your entire community at risk.
And I think that's a pretty good note to end on. So please listen to the information that Moira has provided, because I think it's important. And please don't talk to cops as a rule. But if you ever are questioned by an FBI agent, don't lie, because that is a felony.
It is an independent offense. Please. Yeah. One of the reasons that I always tell people, and that we always tell people, it's much better not to speak to federal agents, is that if you have a constitutional right not to speak to a federal agent, lying to a federal agent, even unintentionally, is a federal offense.
Sure is.
Wow. Moira, is there anything that you would like us to plug for you?
There is, actually. The first thing that I would like to plug is the concept of not talking to law enforcement. The second thing I would like to plug is the concept of only using water to get pepper spray and tear gas out of your eyes.
Yes.
I would also like to
say it again for the people in the back.
I would also like to plug the National Lawyers Guild New York City chapter Twitter account, which is NLGNYC News, and the National Lawyers Guild New York City chapter Instagram account, where there are lots of very beautiful informational tiles written by attorneys and designed by amazing Black artists and graphic designers that you can look at and share. And the Twitter handle for that is at NLG, as in National Lawyers Guild, _ NYC, as in New York City.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing all of that with us. Robert,
alrighty.
Is there anything you would like to plug before I give our social meds?
No, I've never done anything but this exact podcast being recorded right now, Sophie, so I'm not sure what I'd even plug. Yeah, this is the entirety of my body of work.
That's fake news. But you can follow this podcast at Worst Year Pod on Twitter and Instagram. You can follow Robert at I Write Okay on Twitter, not Instagram. Robert has a new series called Behind the Police, which you can listen to in the Behind the Bastards feed.
Where you sure can.
Where we talk about how fucking awful the police have been since the very, 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 very beginning. And you can follow Katie Stoll, who's not here, at Katie Stoll. You can follow Cody at Dr. Mr. Cody. And you can follow me on Twitter at y_Sophie_y. That was weird. I didn't like that. But go ahead.
You can follow your heart.
Yes.
Out into the streets and to engage in your legal right to dissent.
And once again, all of Maura's advice. Don't talk to cops.
Everything's so dumb. Everything's so dumb. And it's gonna get dumber.
Great.
I tried.
Daniel? Lovely.
Okay, so during this afternoon's recording, I managed to say that the Klan had a coherent set of beliefs when what, in fact, I should have said is that the Klan has a unitary and authoritative set of beliefs. I misnamed the jurisdiction in which the J-20 prosecutions occurred. I said it was prosecuted in the D.C. Circuit. I think what I was trying to say was that the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia prosecuted those cases. So, again, what it should say is that prosecutors from the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia ran up against problems trying to make a case for conspiracy. I think I also managed to refer to the Instagram handle of the NLG_NYC account as the Twitter handle. So again, that should be the Instagram handle is at NLG_NYC.
Worst Year Ever is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.